Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All this week, WBUR is taking a special look at the massive growth of the Massachusetts life sciences sector in a special series we're calling BioBoom. And when you think of the economic growth, the construction, the jobs, the new science, all that's going on in and around Kendall Square, it's easy to slip into thinking that it's all an unalloyed good, especially for Cambridge. But how has the bio-boom changed Cambridge for all of the city's residents? What are the ups and downs of those rising property values, tax revenues, and higher-paying jobs? And as the city rapidly changes, what's the relationship like between its thriving biotech sector and the city more broadly? So Cambridge residents, today we want to hear from you. How has your city changed with the bio-boom? And do you like what you see? Or do you think things could be improved? And if so, how and where? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston to talk about your community in the midst of this enormous change. So here today to help us think through this is Kenneth Salim. He's the superintendent of Cambridge Public Schools. Superintendent Salim, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Iram Farouk. She's the Assistant City Manager for Community Development for the City of Cambridge. Iram Farouk, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So let me just get a really quick sense from both of you to sort of set the groundwork here. In the past 5-10 years or so, Iram, and let me start with you, how would you describe how Cambridge has changed as the biotech sector booms?
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So clearly there has been an incredible growth in Cambridge in the biotech sector, and that has had implications for the city in terms of financial stability. After the manufacturing industry moved mm-hmm. out, Cambridge was in the doldrums for quite a while. But I think it's a very different story now. So for us to be able to be a city that can provide a high level of services to our residents and be a great place that people want to live and work is something that, to a great extent, can be attributed to that financial stability that comes from the strong business environment, a big chunk of which right now is biotech and the knowledge economy.
Can I just jump in here? So do you think that those benefits have been equitably shared across Cambridge, though?
Some of them have, but clearly there are implications, because as you become a desirable place to live and a desirable place to work, there are a lot more people who want to live and work there. And so that has implications in terms of affordability of space, whether it's housing or it's commercial space. Mm-hmm. And so we certainly see the impacts of that on our demographics, also on the sets of businesses and retail that can thrive yeah. in the city, so that there's certainly a change in those particular characteristics.
Right. So, for example, smaller businesses, mom and pop retail, not being able to support the rents that are now being demanded for a lot of Cambridge commercial spaces.
Yes.
Okay. Well, so we're going to come back to that in a second, but let me turn to you, Kenneth Salim, the superintendent for Cambridge Public Schools. I mean. I love numbers. I was diving to all sorts of numbers about Cambridge Public Schools, which we can dig into in just a moment. But the same question, I should just start with you. How has the school system changed in the past decade or so?
I think there certainly have been some significant changes in terms of the makeup of the school system. While overall, just to even start with some of the numbers, overall about 45% of our student population is eligible for free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. But that in some ways masks, I think, even the distribution that we have seen that has become wider over time. And that I think because there is a really a shrinking middle class,
The distribution meaning the highest income.
Highest and the lowest
versus
income.
The lowest.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So there can continue to be, I think, certainly families from low-income backgrounds who live in poverty. There are housing developments that exist in Cambridge. At the same time, there are certainly families from wealthier backgrounds where we see those tales of that bimodal distribution even further apart.
And has that produced any new pressures or any new, tensions in the schools that weren't there before?
I think what it really has us look at is this idea around equity and access, mm-hmm. and even demands, I think, even greater attention to it, because we do have families of privilege that are maybe able to give that many more resources and out-of-school time and those types of opportunities where, you know, students may be learning to code at home, whereas some other families whose children may have to fill in for a child care, or high school students may have to take on an after-school job. So for us, as we think about our role as a school district, it's about recognizing that we're trying to provide equity and access to all students and really ensure that those that don't have those opportunities are able to access them through the schools and through the rich partnerships that we have in the school district.
Well, we're talking about how the city of Cambridge as a whole has changed and grown as the biotech sector in and around Kendall Square has blossomed. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Would love to hear from you if you live in Cambridge or have lived there, how you've seen Cambridge change and what you think needs continual improvement, what you like about it, what you don't like about it, because there's a lot going on there right now. And Superintendent Salim, if I could, we've got a call here right about schools. So let me just turn to this caller. Jay is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Jay.
Hi, how are you? My concern is, as an educator in Cambridge, we at the high school have a school that is only 8 years old. It cost a lot of money to build. It's already too small. There isn't parking. Salaries have not kept pace, so teachers are moving out of Cambridge and driving half an hour to an hour to get into the city to go to a school without parking. And, it's very difficult.
Mm. Jay, thank you so much for your call. Superintendent Salim, you want to respond to that?
It is something that we see as I talk with teachers. I think it's not uncommon for me to talk with a teacher that maybe has just recently had a child and is, you know, making many of our teachers are in that that life stage. And sometimes they're looking, maybe they're currently resident in Cambridge and looking to live elsewhere. And so that does have downstream effects when I think about in many other communities where many of the staff are able to live in the same community. They might be more involved in the community in different ways, whether through coaching or through other community-based organizations and institutions. And so that certainly is something that I hear about from educators and from families as well. And it's one of the challenges certainly around cost of living.
Well, Iram Farouk, let me turn back to you because you're Assistant City Manager for Community Development in Cambridge. And our caller Jay there was just talking about teachers perhaps not being able to, as many teachers as before, being able to afford to live in Cambridge itself. So, I mean, tell me, how much does the growth of the biotech sector sort of inform how the city looks at future development projects?
Yeah. So one of the things that we have done is really emphasize housing, and particularly housing affordability in the city. So to the question about being priced out of the city, I think the biggest thing that the city could do is to try to try to create more housing units, so that part of it is that the market helps to stabilize itself, so that there is so we catch up with the demand to some degree. But part of it is also to create more and more deed-restricted units, which we do through a couple different avenues. And one is through all new residential development. We ask for 20% of the square footage to be dedicated now for housing that's affordable to people who make up to 80% of the
area's
median.
That's the inclusionary development rule.
That's the inclusionary. And on the commercial side, when somebody develops commercial space, we also have what's called incentive zoning. And so for each square foot that they develop, they have to pay a certain amount that goes to the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and those funds are utilized for creation and preservation of affordable housing, and that number is currently, it changes with CPI, and it's also slated to increase in September of 18, but right now it's $14.95 per square foot of new commercial development.
So, you know, these are all laudable efforts, right, and aims, but at the same time, as you well know, the current reality of the market pressures in Cambridge are enormous, right? I was just looking at some documentation from the city itself saying, for example, rental prices for a two-bedroom, I'm seeing here, as of 2016, it was hovering close, median rent was hovering close to $3,000 a month. So, I mean, just for you know, just to rent a two-bedroom in Cambridge, someone would have to be already bringing in more than $36,000 a year after taxes and all sorts of other things. And that's it's hard to imagine how long that is sustainable for.
That is that's absolutely true, that the rental prices as well as home buying purchase prices have increased quite a bit. So yes, certainly, like you cited, that what used to be the price to rent a two-bedroom, you now have to pay to rent a one-bedroom in the span of about 10 years. Mm. So there is certainly a significant change, but the housing problem is not just confined, you know, within Cambridge. So it's a regional problem. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we are working, not just in Cambridge, but as a region collectively, is to think through what are our housing needs going to be in the future. So there are 15 core communities in the urban core who are working to figure out what are our targets, what is the appropriate then share for each city to create. So Cambridge tends to be creating more than what our allocated share typically would be. So we are certainly trying, but keep in mind we're a city of 6.25 square miles total. So we can create but it is still
a regional
something
problem
that we all have to be working on together.
No, this is a theme that's come up on the show many times. I take your point there. But I want to take a step back here for a second and turn back to you, Superintendent Salim, because you know this isn't an either or issue, right? It's sort of a both and issue in terms of the drawbacks and positives of having a really booming sector in a city, because you know the flip side to those high home prices and those high rents is this enormous tax base that the city of Cambridge has. And you know, we've spent the past couple of days looking at some numbers around school construction in Cambridge. Right, have built three new schools essentially, none of which received and significant state funding at all because Cambridge didn't need it, or the state of Massachusetts didn't think that the city needed it. I can't think of another city in Massachusetts that can say that. It's what, $500 million of construction?
Yeah, it's really an amazing opportunity that we have as a school district to be able to provide truly world-class facilities for our students and for our teachers and for our families. We're I think not only creating these exceptional learning spaces, but ones that are really environmentally friendly and, you know, actually net zero plus in the case of the current construction of the Cambridge Street Upper School King Open building on Cambridge Street. And so it is tremendous. And as you said, that tax base, it's not just for capital projects, but it's also for our operating budget in the schools as well. And so the ability to have the size of schools that we have, to be able to have the value of small schools, to have the types of specialists, social workers, counselors, school psychologists, and others that many schools struggle to staff, we're fortunate to have in Cambridge.
Mm. Well, you're hearing Kenneth Salim, he's the superintendent of Cambridge Public Schools, and Iram Farooq, she's assistant city manager for community development for the city of Cambridge. And we are talking about how Cambridge has changed and is changing as the bio boom continues in and around Kendall Square. I'm going to get to callers here in just a second, but I want to welcome in another voice into the conversation. He's John Summers. He's founder of a nonprofit publishing company called Lingua Franca Media, and he's former editor of the Baffler, a magazine of art and art criticism. John Summers, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what's your take? Do you like the way Cambridge has been changing in the past decade or so?
Well, part of it I like, sure. I've been here since the year 2000. This is my 18th year. Cambridge is my second home, and there are many aspects of the city that I like very much. At the same time, of course, in the period that I've been here, the cultural trend has accelerated in one direction only, and that is in the direction of decline of, you could call them kind of scruffy or edgy cultural enterprises. You mentioned mom-and-pop stores a few minutes ago. These are kind of mom-and-pop culture shops, art galleries and bookstores, theater companies and musical venues and independent magazines, journalism. One would encounter these expressions on the street of Cambridge more so 15, 16, 17 years ago than one does anymore.
Yeah,
that is not a numbers-based conclusion, but a subjective impression. Mm. But I think one that most of your listeners will nod their heads to if they've been here long enough. And are fortunate enough to have been able to stay.
Well, John, can you hold on here for a second? Because I
sure.
think you bring up an important point. I want to turn it back to Iram Farooq here, because what John said makes me think of, you know, I mean, we're talking about Kendall Square here, but let me just move up the road here to Harvard Square, for example, and how sort of authentic old Harvard Square is still there a little bit, but it does seem to be a much more sort of sanitized corporate in feel and environment to it than it did 10, let alone 20 years ago. I mean, do you think that as the city is evolving and changing with this new industry, is there a risk of losing sort of that authentic Cambridge?
I would attribute what you're describing not so much to biotech and the pressures that that brings, because I think that that may be a false correlation, but certainly to the fact that there are these macro trends in the world right now in terms of where people shop and how they choose to invest their time and where they go. And while we all have I came here more than 20 years ago, mm. and I have that similar romantic recollection of the Harvard Square at the time that I landed in Cambridge. But the truth of the matter is that we all need to be supporting those businesses and enterprises that we want to see remain in the city, because it is more competition for the same amount of space. And it is true that this is the world that we live in. It's all private property. And so it's transactional in its nature, and there is certainly the issue that if somebody who can afford to pay, whether that be a retailer or a business, mm-hmm. Somebody who's willing to pay more, and the same process that I described on the housing side plays out
right.
on the commercial side
right.
as well. So we got to kind of shop with, we got to support these places that we want to see stay.
Let me give John a chance to respond to that. What do you think, John?
Well, that's a response that one hears, nostalgia, romanticism, and then the answer is always, well, it's more or less destiny. What can we do about it? This is happening all over the place. And it's just not true. The idea that city planners can do nothing about it is not true. In fact, city planners have done quite a lot to define the kind of culture that is, in fact, legitimate and acceptable in this area. For example, we have a cultural district now in Central Square, a kind of demarcated area where I suppose there's culture, and if you're not in that block, there's not culture. We have something called a creative economy, and the definition of a creative economy is any cultural expression that meets commercial success. The idea of having culture that doesn't sell is just simply inconceivable these days, and I think it's important to remember what we lose when we lose that. We don't only produce the kind of dull and bland culture that you see in Kendall Square, for example, which is, you know, aesthetically hideous. You also lose something much more important. You lose a kind of vision of the future, or an imagination of alternative models that a robust cultural sphere that's independently produced and supported often has given us
yeah.
the best.
You know, I want to get to some calls here, but you've said some really interesting things there, John. I just want to give Iram another chance to respond if you'd like.
I guess the only thing I would say is that I did not mean to suggest that the only thing that has value is that which generates funding. But I will say that my favorite artist and my favorite musician both died penniless, and they are not from today. They are from decades and centuries ago. And so this is not a new phenomenon. It has always been this way.
No, it hasn't.
Well, I'm going to get some calls in here, if I could, because we got a lot of people who want to have their say. Let's turn to David, who's calling from Lexington. You're on the air, David.
Hi, Magna. Great show. I wanted to say that I'm in the house that my in Lexington that my parents bought in 1962. I bought the house from the estate in 04. The property taxes, inflation adjusted, were the same when my parents bought the house as when I bought it in 04.
Mm-hmm.
They have doubled since then, and I think Lexington's doing that because they can, because they have a lot of, you know, much wealthier people than used to live here. It's just crazy. And I've also noticed that the traffic going into Cambridge and the traffic, you know, in the Big Dig, which was really freed up by the Big Dig, they're all getting
worse. Yeah, definitely traffic is another one of those region-wide problems. David, thank you so much for your call. Iram Farooq, let me just turn back to you for a second, because he was talking about property taxes in Lexington, but I was reading that in Cambridge over the past several years, the city has actually sort of kept property taxes, residential property taxes, fairly level.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's lower than surrounding communities as well.
It is significantly lower. It's one of the lowest property taxes.
Property tax rates, I want to be
tax
specific.
Tax rate in the state. But even in terms of absolute property taxes, the city works incredibly hard on the finance side to really try to make sure that residential property taxes in absolute numbers don't go up for people in a way that is a shock, the way that the caller was describing, because certainly there are a lot of people, even now in Cambridge, who are house rich, cash poor, and the city really does not want to put them in the situation that the caller was describing.
Right, and it's one of those things that maybe Cambridge, at least for now, is able to do because the commercial tax base is growing as much as it is. I was seeing that, according to a 2016 and fiscal report from the city of Cambridge, that the top 10 taxpayers, commercial taxpayers, in the city of Cambridge pay more than 32% of all the tax receipts that the city collects. So we'll see again. That's what it is now. How long it's sustainable is another question. I want to turn to Meredith, who is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Meredith.
Thanks so much for a very interesting conversation. This question is directed toward the superintendent. So as you've alluded to, Cambridge has the great good fortune of having a very high per pupil allocation, I believe one of the highest in the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, just to jump in there, Meredith, it's the only ones that are higher are out on the Cape in terms of per pupil.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And one of the other statistics that I've become interested in is when you look at what standardized assessment tests are telling us about the gap in performance between students categorized as low income and those categorized as not being low income. Mm-hmm. And I believe, at least according to the data I analyzed a year or so ago, Cambridge is at the very upper tip there as well. That is to say, has one of the largest gaps in performance between low income and non-low income students.
Meredith, let me just... sorry, was your question, you wanted the superintendent to respond to that? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, as you look at districts across the state who talk about how financial resources are key to closing the achievement gap, I'm wondering how you balance spending on things like world-class facilities with spending on programs more specifically directed to close that achievement gap and serve the lowest income student.
Right. Meredith, thank you so much for your call. And just for people who don't know, we were looking at the latest numbers for per pupil spending in Cambridge, and it's roughly $29,000 per student in the city of Cambridge per year. So, Superintendent, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. So it's exactly right. And I think that why I wanted to point out that while it's not just capital investments, but also investments in the schools and in the classroom, which are really essential, and that it absolutely is our focus to look at narrowing some of those opportunity and achievement gaps that we see in Cambridge. And it's not just, as I think we see here, it's not about how much money, but about how that money is spent, how the resources are utilized, and really focusing on the needs of our students that are most vulnerable. And I think that...
Isn't Meredith implying, though, that the $29,000 per year perhaps isn't being utilized in the most effective way if the achievement gap is so large in Cambridge?
It is. And that's why I think, and I agree with that, I think that as we're looking at what we've done is to try to really create a focused vision around our work that focuses on narrowing those opportunity and achievement gaps. And that's how, when circling back to the beginning of the conversation around industry and Kendall Square, how we're thinking about partnerships as well with different companies is about how we support students that may not otherwise have access to those resources. So thinking about when we have partnerships with the Biogen Foundation, which is looking at how we really provide STEM and STEAM opportunities for students in out-of-school time that provide exposure, internships, mentorships, having students be able to see other professionals that look like them is something that we don't have enough in public education.
Right.
And certainly,
so I'm wondering, are you actively advocating amongst the biotech leaders in Cambridge now for more of that kind of support?
So I think one of the ways that I think that those partnerships have evolved is that they've become stronger with greater collaboration. So I think in looking at what the needs are of the schools, needs are of the school district, thinking about the population of students that we serve, that's not just enough to offer a program and open the doors, because we know that those that may have access to information or have different networks are able to access those, but to be really intentional about thinking about the students that traditionally have not accessed those opportunities.
Well, you know, the time goes by so quick in these conversations. And so, John Summers, you're going to get the last word today in the last 30 seconds that we have here. And I want you to just look forward with me for a moment. What do you hope for Cambridge in the coming 5 years? John Summers, you still there? Looks like we lost John. So, Iram Farouk, you're the lucky one who gets the last word today. I mean, you work on city on development and planning in Cambridge. What do you hope for your city in the next 5 years?
Well, we're working right now on a citywide comprehensive plan called Envision Cambridge that's looking across all disciplines to figure out a pathway to have a more environmentally sustainable, equitable, and prosperous community as we go forward. And so I think that starts to take its fingers into all of these topics that we've been talking about. And I think Ken mentioned collaboration, which really has been, we've discovered, the greatest point of creating value beyond what each of the individual pieces can do by themselves. And so we are working very hard to create greater collaborations between industry and city.
Well, Iram Farouk is the Assistant City Manager for Community Development in the City of Cambridge. Thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you so much. And Kenneth Salim, Superintendent of Cambridge Public Schools, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Listen, listeners, head over to our website at radioboston.org and let us know if I didn't get you on the phone here today, I'm sorry, but how do you think Cambridge has changed and is changing, and what do you want for the city's future as this bio boom continues? Again, that's radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.